3. Can you remember your first impressions of Ethiopia?
Yes. I think impressions of being a very beautiful country, high up in the mountains, eucalyptus trees seem to be everywhere, very clear atmosphere, you know, very clear to look through at the blue skies and the racing clouds. I suppose one second impression for those of us who hadn't been to poor African countries before was the abject poverty of the local inhabitants, although I must say that nowhere during my time in Ethiopia did I see anyone actually starving. And that, I think, is probably significant, that the droughts in Africa hadn't come at that time. I mean, the droughts which have been the feature of the last 20 years, I suppose. And also, I suppose, the great surge to the cities hadn't taken place. So they seemed to have adequate food, albeit of a very, mainly pulses and vegetables rather than meat. Meat was for high days and feasts. I suppose another reaction was the very handsome-looking Amharas. One had been seen pictures, but they were very noble-featured people. Although regionally they were very different from the Somalis and the people down towards the coast in the Danakil Desert, where you had these wonderful tall women with rings around their necks. But the mountain people were these very fine-featured, light-skinned Amharas, I suppose. Ethnically, they were closely related to the Egyptians and Middle East people. But those were first impressions. Then, of course, looking at the primitive conditions, and one was conscious of what had been under the Italians quite a well-developed and highly organized local structure, from houses which would do credit to anywhere in the West, modern villas, the buildings, several very well-built hospitals but now completely denuded. Many of these houses were denuded and had been almost taken over by the local inhabitants, so you very often found a villa with several people living in it, cooking there with a fire and the smoke. Although they got the chimney, they'd still have the smoke in the room. Because the Italian population had been, the males had been taken to prisoner of war camp, and the females had been, I think, evacuated. Just where, I'm not quite sure, but they weren't left in Ethiopia. So you had a bit of a ghost area, but what the Italians did leave was, as I say, well-equipped at that stage, well-equipped hospitals, and a wonderful road system, which sadly soon fell into decay.
Was there any railway as well?
There's just the one railway, which comes up from Djibouti right up to Addis Ababa. And that was the main access, and had been, I suppose, I'm not quite sure when it was built, but I guess in probably the 1850s, 60s or something like that. It had certainly been there for 50 years or more when we got there. It had its breakdowns, but it was the lifeline from Ethiopia down to Djibouti, of course, at that time was still French, or just been taken over by the British from the French.
Could you now tell me about Addis itself when you went there? You know, this would have been just after the Italians, wouldn't it?
Yes.
You know, what sort of Italian influence was there?
I think still quite strong. As I say, these villas, the roads, the hospitals, the schools, the hotels, one or two hotels even.
Was it a sort of Western place then?
Yes, in a way, a total mixture, a Western place on a small scale, because that had been used exclusively by the Italians. But then a mile or two out, the rural area looking just as it had, I suppose, for 1,000 years, with little round houses called tukuls, where the Ethiopian population lived again, much as they had for thousands of years, I guess.
Did you come to any conclusion as to how the Ethiopians had fared under the Italians?
Yes. They'd certainly been treated, dominated, as second-class citizens, used only for menial tasks and servants. I wasn't aware, but of course I had no possibility of knowing directly, but I didn't get the impression that they'd been physically abused, except, I've no doubt, for those who were regarded as political ringleaders, who no doubt were marched off and never seen again. But I didn't get the impression that they were a total serf-like people. Their reactions, they quickly could tell who were Italians and who were British, although we were all white and looked the same. So they were very anti-Italian, but as I say, I think the Italians, remember that the Italians were emigrants from Italy, where they were underprivileged in Italy, and part of Mussolini's plan had been to colonise Ethiopia. And so he poured vast sums into the infrastructure, hence the hospitals, the schools, the roads. And the Italians there were very much come out to a new country where they were given land and expected, and did, make a wonderful life for themselves. And of course they all lost that. The Ethiopians inherited it. Tragically, because of shortage of funds and sometimes, I think, lack of political will, this infrastructure wasn't kept up. I think there's bound to be a degree of corruption, so that the funds very often didn't get to the right areas. And I do remember one of our greatest battles, which was carried out mainly by our commandant, who spent most of his time arguing with the Ministry of the Interior to allocate more funds for the medical hospitals and clinics and training. And that was I suppose he was very well suited to do that, and did it superbly well, but even so, it was frustrating, and promises of yes, oh, it's on the way, but of course didn't turn up. So we were getting screams, a request from these outlying clinics, where letters took weeks, and we'd give them some indication, yes, the supplies were on the way, medical supplies, and they hadn't arrived, and they were people in the field getting more and more frustrated. And of course we felt impotent, because we were the we can only make our supplications to the ministers. I think on several occasions our commandant made direct appeals to the emperor himself. And I remember I certainly had to make a personal application to the empress on behalf of the lepers who were all congregated in this camp about 10 miles from Addis Ababa, who were literally going without food at that stage. I said I didn't see starvation, but these lepers couldn't do anything for themselves and were dependent just as inmates depending on food. And the head man told me unless they got food, they were all going to do a march on the palace. And this message I relayed through, and it was probably significant that loads of food arrived within a day or two, and the Empress herself came up and sort of displayed succor, and I remember leaving. She left a lot of dollars for the local people. But it was a constant battle of inadequate medical supplies was our main problem.
Was there a lot of destruction, war destruction? You know, I'm thinking of the liberation of Ethiopia. Did you see vehicles or signs of that?
It was really I'm sure you'd be able to check on your on the military history, but it was really an incredible campaign where small British forces, partly through stealth and wit and fooling the Italians into a belief that the force was 10 times stronger than in fact it was, took charge with, I think, minimum casualty and destruction. The chap who takes a lot of credit for this was the maverick general who then went on to Burma, Chindit. What was his name? The general. It'll come to me, probably.
Yes, don't worry about that, Tom. You know, it's just it's interesting to know how the war situation seemed. I was wondering now, you know, with the FAU unit there, how did that fit into, say, the military medical and the Ethiopian medical?
Yes.
Could you explain that, do you think?
Yes. The military had small detachments throughout the northern part of Ethiopia as bases of occupation and presumably as a minimum presence should anything in the Middle East turn sour again. And so the military attachments, apart from being in Addis Ababa, were in half a dozen strategic cities, towns, largely in the north: Asmara, Tigray, Gondar, Adowa, Deborah Baham. And they, apart from training the Ethiopian army, had, of course, their own, their own medical doctors, many of whom were Palestinian doctors. But these weren't responsible, although they gave a lot of very valuable aid, the Palestinian doctors did, were not responsible for the local civilian population. Their job was to look after the military situation and train the military. And so although they were based there and got on very well with our local people, it wasn't their responsibility. The responsibility for the civilian population was the medical services under the Ethiopian government, and we constituted the largest part of that. And so our funds and organisation had to report through to the Ethiopian ministries, we kept in a very close liaison with the military, of course, who were responsible only for the military. But there was a lot of liaison between, both of use of transport and helping out at each other as and when. And so very often our local chaps, I seem to remember in Gondar, where we had a crew of about three, also treated the military establishment, which was also at Gondar, but who hadn't got a resident medical man there. So you got a great fraternisation and close friendships, and very close friendships were built up like that.
But it would seem then, from what you've said, that your medical role in Ethiopia at this time, the FAU, was very, very, you know, it was a big responsibility and a big role. Is that right?
It is.
You would have been virtually the only medical people there, would you, for the civilian population?
I think there were, I know in Addis Ababa there were one or two doctors who had been seconded from, there was a very famous Australian doctor there. There were several medical missionaries that had come back after the occupation, and they brought doctors. But by far and away, we were by far and away the largest medical unit operating in Ethiopia. And in large parts of the country, we're the only medical unit operating. Some areas, clinics being responsible, the only medical services in an area half the size of Wales, probably.
And am I right in thinking that some of the people wouldn't have been, you know, actually trained doctors? But
oh, yes. Very often they wouldn't be trained doctors, but these key six or seven doctors we did have, they would be visiting these places, but of course this wouldn't be any good because they would be probably visiting once a month. And if somebody had got a crisis today, it's no good saying, well, there'll be a doctor here in a month's time. So you did what you could on the spot.
Responsibility must have been very great there.
It was, and we were worried about one or two of these people who were isolated and very young, how they were going to stand up to it. And we did try to get out to see them, but it wasn't very practical, and I suppose they didn't receive a visit from either the commandant or a doctor or myself. Sometimes I think the longest period went for about 2 or 3 months when they didn't see a single soul.
The Australian doctor, what was his name?
Dr. Last. Funny, now the name comes back. It was an Australian, I think seconded from the Australian Army, and he was a brilliant surgeon and took charge of the, by far and away, the most sophisticated hospital in Addis Ababa, called the Haile Selassie Hospital. And he had, I think, a couple of Australian nurses with him, and he, I think, did tremendous work. That was a hospital used largely by the expatriate population in Addis Ababa, from embassies down to the more affluent Ethiopians. That hospital didn't cope with the vast majority of the poor in the city, and it was another hospital that had one or two Italian doctors who'd been with the British authority, had been left in the key areas, and backed up by our unit and also two of our doctors. And this was the other large hospital that catered in Addis Ababa for the vast majority of the people. That would be Dr. Stilwellyn, who is Peggy's brother, and several other doctors, a doctor husband, Dr. Vasey, who was our chief medical man, didn't spend much time there, He spent a lot of time travelling around the country.
What was the name of that hospital?
Hermanuel Hospital. And if you're meeting anyone, are you meeting anyone by the name of Robert Cook, who lives in Taunton? Is it? No, it's not Taunton, it's Newton Abbott, I knew it was down there. He was the manager, chief administrator, call it what you will, of this vast complex, and did a wonderful job in providing medical services. Then there were about three satellite clinics, of which I ran one, at the Tekla Hymenot. That was about 2 or 3 miles from the Emmanuel Hospital. And cases I couldn't deal with, I referred on to the hospital.
Could you tell me something about the conditions in that hospital when the unit first went there?
Yes.
And the sort of patients and their diseases?
Well, it was really a shell with inadequate beds, mattresses, no drugs, sanitation appalling, and people were just congregating there, I think, virtually to die. There was one very good Italian doctor who was a very humane man who was battling as best he could, but with no backup, and wouldn't have the temerity to approach the medical authorities because he was a wretched Italian. If he said anything that didn't please him, he was likely to be behind bars anyway. So he welcomed the arrival of the unit, who were able to speak their minds and make direct application for funds right through, if needs be, right through to the Emperor himself. And this was a major task and a great success, because from getting mattresses, beds, dispensary, operating theatre, and a lot of this equipment was bought out by FAU from UK, we were able to get a very good medical service, and our young doctors and surgeons did wonderful operations there.
How about water? What was that situation?
Well, I think that there's no great shortage of water in Addis Ababa. The water shortage is much more in the north, and it does seem to be a factor of the last 20 years and drought. So I wasn't conscious of a shortage of water. I was conscious very much of polluted water, and several of our chaps had training, specialist training, in sanitation, because they recognised that the treatment of this was to avoid epidemics of typhus and all the waterborne diseases as well. And so public health, one or two of our chaps were working closely with a part of the medical military there in cleaning up Addis Ababa. And this ranged from digging latrines and trenches to trying to cope with the flies and the, you know, teaching of basic sanitation.
How far did you get with that? Did you make an impression, do you think?
I think one taught the dangers, which they readily understood, the dangers that arise from insanitary conditions. Typhus was rampant when we went there, and I well remember that some poor patient had crawled in under his shama, which is his sort of gown, and he'd be absolutely alive with lice, which was the carrier of typhus germ. And so the standard routine, both in hospitals and special clinics, and a lot of propaganda, was to take off all their clothes. If you feel there's anybody in your community got typhus, take off all your clothes, burn those, and shave the heads. That's to get rid of the lice. Burn all the clothes and shave their heads, and then put them through whatever disinfectant you've got. And that, of course, was a very effective way of dealing, probably the only way of dealing with the typhus epidemic as it raged.
Did you have problems with that, you know, with modesty? You know, were they modest people?
Yes, and of course some were too poor to give up their clothes for burning. So one usually was able to give them a white sheet or something, which they took. Going back to public health and sanitation, malaria was a great problem, not so much in Addis Ababa itself, which was at 9,000 feet and just above the level, but in most of the surrounding areas, malaria was a great killer. And again, it was the knowledge that these were mosquitoes and that they must get a cover and they mustn't live near stagnant water. And of course, this is long before the day of DDT and the official campaigns. So, yes, public health was an important thing, and a great deal of propaganda was also done on education on venereal diseases, where they had the strangest ideas of what had caused venereal disease, which was of course very rampant. And as these, how long it had been there, I don't know. Some said it was introduced by the Italians. But certainly they seem to have very little combative immunology against it, as they did with, as they had little against diseases like TB. They went down like ninepins with both TB and venereal disease. So there was an educative process here. There was an educative process about leprosy, which I had particular concern about, because leprosy was a very great scourge in that part of Africa. And this again was an educative thing, because it was believed by many of them that this was an act of God, heredited, and of course it's no such thing, it was environmental. And that children, as they are born, are totally free from leprosy, as they are from tuberculosis. But if they stay for any length of time with their infected parents, then they themselves will pick it up. As we know, TB in this area was rampant until just before the Second World War. So, there's an educative process there. In fact, looking back on it, I would think probably our most valuable work was educative in public health, impressing on the locals that they could do a lot to help themselves by cleanliness, ruining the mythology, and general hygiene. And looking back on it, although that was less romantic than saving somebody's life, it probably long term was our biggest contribution, I think.
Did the patients have to pay for the medical attention in
your
hospital?
They were encouraged to give whatever they'd got, but they were never turned down because they hadn't got it. And the reason they were encouraged to give, you had two classes of patients. Some who were really very wealthy by local standards, and who you felt you were getting some minimum funds to help the others. And secondly, and I suppose this is a fact of life, certainly in developing countries, that if it's for free, it's very often not valued. And even if they're only giving the smallest token, which is something to them, they felt that they were getting better treatment. In fact, some of them, unless you charge them, felt that you were fobbing them off with something that wasn't worth buying anyway. Usually, the gifts were in kind. So they'd bring you anything from eggs to chickens to Lord knows what, which obviously you couldn't do anything with, but you always knew there was a beggar around the corner who could. But it was basically a free service. Had to be, emergency service.
What were the other main diseases, you know, apart from malaria and typhus? Did you have things like smallpox and
certainly meningitis. Meningitis.